Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
In Kansas City, Missouri, United States, a 16-year-old black teenager, Ralph Yell, was shot when he went to the wrong address to pick up his brothers. The incident happened on Thursday evening, 13th of April. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. An 84-year-old white man who shot a black teenager who approached the wrong house in Kansas City, Missouri, to pick up his younger brothers, has been charged with first-degree assault, the Clay County prosecutor said on Monday, 17th of April. Prosecuting attorney Zachary Thompson said at a news conference that there was a racial component to this incident on Thursday night in which Andrew Lester twice shot 16-year-old teenager Ralph Yell, who is recovering at home after being released from the hospital on Sunday. But nothing in the charging document says the shooting was racially motivated, Thompson clarified. We understand how frustrating this has been, but I can assure that the criminal justice system is working and will continue to work, Thompson said at a news conference. The shooting outraged many in Kansas City, Missouri, and across the country. Civic and political leaders demanded justice, and some, including lawyers for Ralph Yell, pressed the racial dimension of this case. The Reverend Vernon Howard, president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Kansas City, called the shooting incident a heinous and hate-filled crime. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris wrote on Twitter, "No child should ever live in fear of being shot for ringing the wrong doorbell." The Missouri Senate held a moment of silence for Ralph Yell on Monday, 17th of April. The assault charge carries a penalty of up to life imprisonment. Lester was also charged with armed criminal action, which has a penalty range of 3 to 15 years in prison. Thompson said an arrest warrant was issued, but Lester was not yet in custody. Ralph Yell, an honors student and all-state band member, was supposed to pick up his two younger brothers on Thursday night, 13th of April, when he approached the wrong house. Lester came to the door and shot the teenager in the forehead and then shot him again in the right forearm, according to the authorities. No words were exchanged before the shooting, the probable cause statement said. But afterwards, as Ralph Yell got up to run, he heard Lester yell, "Don't come around here," the statement said. Ralph Yell rang to multiple homes asking for help before finding someone who would call the police, the statement said. Lester told police that he lives alone and had just gone to bed when he heard his doorbell, according to a probable cause statement. He said he picked up his gun and went to the door, where he saw a black male pulling on the exterior storm door handle and thought someone was trying to break into his house. A number for Lester was not in service on Monday evening, and it was not immediately clear whether he had an attorney to speak on his behalf. The shooting incident happened in a middle-class neighborhood in North Kansas City. Ralph Yell was sent to pick up his brothers, both who are twins. He didn't have a phone with him at the time and went to the wrong block, his aunt Faith Spoonmore wrote on the GoFundMe page set up to help pay his medical bills. By Monday afternoon, $1.4 million had been raised. Police Chief Stacey Graves said that Ralph's parents asked him to pick up his brothers at a home on 115th Terrace, but he mistakenly went to 115th Street, the Kansas City Star reported. Ralph Yar is a bass clarinetist who earned the Missouri All-State Band honorable mention and who plays several instruments in the Metropolitan Youth Orchestra of Kansas City, Spoonmore wrote. A statement from the North Kansas City School District described him as an excellent student and talented musician. His aunt Spoonmore said Ralph is doing well physically and has a lot of trauma to overcome emotionally. By Monday afternoon, 17th of April, the home where the shooting happened had been vandalized. Black spray paint on a side of the house showed a heart with 16, Ralph Yarl's age, in the middle. Egg splattered the front window of the house and the front door. A message seeking comments from Republican Governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, a staunch gun rights supporter, wasn't immediately returned. Civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump is working with Ralph Yarl's family. Crump has represented families in several high-profile cases for black people being shot, including those of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd. He questioned why the shooter wasn't arrested and charged immediately. British newspaper The Independent has also covered this story and tells us more. A white homeowner has walked free from police custody after shooting a black teenager in the head when the boy went to the wrong house to pick up his younger twin brothers. Ralph Yarl, a 16-year-old high school junior, had gone to collect his siblings from a friend's house on 115th Terrace in Kansas City, Missouri, on the evening of Thursday, 13th of April, according to the Kansas City Police. Police said that the teenager got muddled up with the address and accidentally went to a home on 115th Street by mistake. There, Ralph Yarl allegedly rang the doorbell and the homeowner, an unidentified white man, opened fire on him. The man in the home opened the door, looked my nephew in the eye and shot him in the head. My nephew fell to the ground and the man shot him again, the family said on a GoFundMe page. Ben Crump and Lee Merritt, the prominent civil rights attorneys now representing the victim and his family, said that the aspiring Texas A&M University student was shot twice, once in the head and once in the arm. Following the shooting, Ralph Yarl managed to stumble away to some other homes in the neighborhood to get help, according to his family. Unfortunately, he had to run to three different homes before someone finally agreed to help him after he was told to lie on the ground with his hands up. Kansas City Police was called to reports of a shooting incident and arrived to find the teenager outside with gunshot wounds. He was rushed to hospital where the family said he was listed in a critical condition. Under Missouri state law, a person can only be held for 24 hours on suspicion of a felony before officials must either charge or release him. The suspect was released pending further investigation. Kansas City Police Chief Stacey Graves said at a press conference on Sunday that due to Ralph Yarl's injuries, police had been unable to get a formal statement from the victim. However, the police chief said that there was no evidence to date to indicate that the shooting was racially motivated. The information that we have now, it does not say that that is racially motivated. That's still an active investigation. But as a chief of police, I do recognize the racial component in this case, she said. The shooting has been branded a hate crime by the victim's family and has sparked protests in the city demanding justice. Hundreds of residents took to the streets of Kansas City, Missouri on Sunday to march through the Northlands area where the black teenager was shot. Many carried placards reading, "Black Lives Matter, ringing a doorbell is not a crime, and justice for Ralph.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Violence is back again in Sudan as the army and a paramilitary group calling itself the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, are fighting fierce battles in several cities, including the capital Khartoum. The fighting erupted Saturday after weeks of power struggles between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, known as Hemeti or Little Mohamed, who leads the heavily armed RSF. Witnesses said huge blasts and intense gunfire rattled buildings in the suburbs of the capital Khartoum as tanks rumbled on the streets and fighter jets roared overhead.
Now a lot of people are just kind of like hiding in their homes. It's been going on since yesterday morning. It kind of like there was a lull at night, and then it started back up again like early morning, and like 1 or 2, like super loud.
According to Central Committee of Sudan Doctors, scores of people, including civilians, have so far been killed and many others injured. The battles also left several members of the United Nations World Food Program dead, prompting the agency to suspend operation in the impoverished nation. Even a 3-hour pause to open safe passage for humanitarian cases proposed by the United Nations failed to stop the fighting. Heavy gunfire could still be heard in central Khartoum near the airport, and dense black smoke billowed from the surrounding area. The RSF said it was in control of several places, including the airport, the presidential palace, and other strategic locations. The army, however, insisted that they are the ones who are still in control of all those areas. The fighting was soon extended to other regions, cities, and towns, including the western Darfur region and the city of Omdurman. The violence drew international outcry. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for justice without delay. He had earlier warned that an escalation in the fighting would further aggravate the already precarious humanitarian situation. The Arab League and the African Union separately condemned the violence and called for an immediate ceasefire. Russia, China, and the European Union also came out vocal against the intense fighting in Sudan, urging restraint. The fighting in Sudan comes as many around the globe have warned that the conflict could plunge the country into a deeper chaos. After all, if the Northeast African nation is not a country which has seen the most number of coups, but it has been the scene of numerous such moves in its history. It was in April 2019 when former President Omar al-Bashir, who had ruled Sudan since the 1989 coup, was brought down from power by the country's military. That after weeks of mass protests over the cost of basic goods, austerity measures, high inflation, and an end to wheat and fuel subsidies. The Transitional Military Council then took power and agreed to a power-sharing deal with protesters. The outcome? A sovereign council tasked with leading the transition process. The council was said to be ruled by a military figure for 21 months, followed by a civilian rule for 18 months. But a handover of power never happened. Things went ahead the same way until October 2021, when the military ruled by Burhan took control of the government in yet another military coup. The move triggered international aid cuts and sparked near-weekly protests met by a deadly crackdown. That was exactly the time when differences aroused between Burhan and his deputy Daglo. Burhan believed that the coup was necessary to include more factions in politics. Daglo, however, called the coup a mistake that failed to bring about change. Now, given the recent developments in Sudan, both Burhan and Daglo have calculated that the leadership contest is now a zero-sum game and therefore have moved on each other. What seems to be clear is the fact that the Sudanese people, who have already paid a high price for installing a civilian government, are the ones who must stand on the sidelines as both military leaders fight it out till the bitter end. What seems to be of high urgency for Sudan is that power has to be given back to its real owners, the people. However, the fighting and yet another brutal civil war in the Northeast African nation are dashing long-held hopes for a transition to civilian-led democracy. As the Saudi war on Yemen enters its ninth year, authorities from both sides have begun releasing hundreds of prisoners captured during the deadly conflict. The forces in Aden, who were backed by Saudi Arabia during the war, agreed to release 250 Ansarullah fighters and send them back to Sana'a. In return, the Ansarullah movement said it released a total of more than 180 detainees, including Saudis and Sudanese soldiers. The prisoners also include forces loyal to former Saudi-backed Yemeni president Abdel Rabbu Mansour Hadi and send them back to Aden. Among them were high-profile figures, including brother of former president Nasser Mansour Hadi and former Yemeni defense minister Mahmoud al-Sobeihi. The prisoners talked about their feelings as they were set to join their families.
It's the most beautiful day of our lives because we got out of captivity and we're now safely heading to our country and under the protection of the Red Cross.
I now feel proud and honored as I'm returning to the Yemeni land. I will kiss its soil because it's like my tender mother. Greeting to all the Yemeni people.
Those, along with other prisoners, made up of some 900 captives who are released under an agreement reached in Switzerland in March. The agreement was the largest prisoner swap since October 2020. The International Committee of the Red Cross, which managed and facilitated the prisoner swap, said with this act of goodwill, hundreds of families torn apart by conflict are being reunited. Our deep desire is that these releases provide momentum for a broader political solution. Some within the Yemeni government in Sana'a said they expected a flurry of prisoner exchanges during the coming months. They said other such agreements are likely to be struck after the holy month of Ramadan to release all prisoners that can make up around 15,000. The prisoner swap deals, including the one which took place during a three-day period as of Friday, and the possible upcoming agreements, are seen by many around the world as a confidence-building measures aimed at creating trust between the warring sides in Yemen and preparing the grounds for upcoming peace talks. The prisoner swap agreement between Riyadh and Ansarullah movement in Yemen comes as the movement's chief negotiator, Mohammed Abdel Salam, has hailed the negotiations as serious and positive. Abdel Salam says more talks have been planned to discuss outstanding issues, which include a permanent truce, full reopening of the southern ports and Sana'a airport, payment of public sector wages, and the withdrawal of foreign forces from Yemen. Sources say Saudi Arabia is planning to announce the end of the devastating war on Yemen. After all, the kingdom was leading a coalition that has been attacking the impoverished nation since March 2015. To reinstate Hadi, Riyadh launched a brutal war in collaboration with a number of its allies and with arms and logistical support from the United States and several other Western countries. The objective was to crush the Ansarullah movement, which has been ruling the country since Hadi fled to Saudi Arabia in 2015. To achieve its goals, Riyadh used the most sophisticated weapons it purchased from its Western allies against the Yemeni people. Not to mention that the Arab Kingdom imposed an all-out blockade on the country to bring the impoverished nation to its knees. According to UN figures, hundreds of thousands of people have so far been killed and millions of others displaced. The war also destroyed Yemen's vital infrastructure, leaving millions of people across the country in desperate need of vital necessities. UN estimates show some 4.5 million people have been internally displaced and more than two-thirds of the population living below the poverty line. Now, with the recent prisoner swap deal, it seems that Saudi Arabia is seeking to pull out itself from a quagmire that has been very costly on all levels. The princesses in Riyadh seem to have come to the understanding that billions of Saudi petrol dollars have gone into waste and are seeking to make a U-turn in their political approach toward regional and international developments.
International Quds Day Rallies 2023. Massive crowds filled the streets of all major cities in the Islamic Republic. The show of support for Palestinians was astounding, but these rallies were not limited to just Iran. This year, more people came out in support of Al-Quds Day, an occasion designated by the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, over 40 years ago. One day prior to the event, Iran and several Arab countries like Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iraq held naval parades, something not done in the past. Then came the show of support by resistance groups and religious leaders.
It is enough for the Arabs and the Muslims in the world and all the peoples of the world. And also, Al-Quds has its significance for Palestine. And this is part and parcel of the religious duties in this state. We need to shoulder the efforts to support the West Bank and Al-Quds.
But why was this Quds Day different? For starters, the Al-Aqsa Mosque was a scene of multiple violations and desecrations by Israeli forces and settlers. The beating of Palestinian worshippers brought world condemnation against Israel and its officials. In the spotlight, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and extreme far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. When it came to the issue of Al-Quds, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was forced to announce that the Al-Aqsa Mosque would be limited only to Palestinian worshippers until the end of the holy month of Ramadan. His minister Itamar Ben-Gvir slammed the move. Many saw that as a sign of a further rift with Netanyahu. Never before, Israel is finding itself to be isolated and weak. On the one hand, Israel is unraveling from within. Strikes and protests against the so-called judicial reforms to have extended to over 3 months now. Meanwhile, Israelis are leaving Israel en masse. On the other hand, the economy is being battered. Massive capital flights, investor confidence at an all-time low. After all, who wants to invest in an economy where there are massive protests in which the fate of the ruling coalition is not known? His partnership with what some have called fascists and extremists has deteriorated Israel's standing, even with its staunchest allies, especially the U.S. A group of U.S. senators have urged the U.S. president not to use taxpayers' money in Israeli settlements and to stop violating Palestinian rights. According to a recent poll by Gallup, for the first time, more Democrats sympathize with Palestinians than they do with Israelis. 49% of Democrats answered that they sympathize more with Palestinians, an 11-point increase over the past year. Meanwhile, Israel is facing an unprecedented national security threat from resistance groups. Recently, a barrage of rockets from resistance groups from southern Lebanon was met with a counterfire from Israel, which only targeted open areas, in fear of not getting involved in a war, especially with Hezbollah. And a further threat to Israel, the geopolitical shift in West Asia from Iran's reconciliation with Saudi Arabia has thrown Israel's security to a state of red alert. Israeli hopes of normalization with Saudi Arabia appear to be dashed, at least for now. Counting on Arab-Israeli alliance in the face of Iran and the axis of resistance is over, said the Hezbollah chief, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. As a result of Iran-Saudi normalization, the axis of resistance has been recalibrated, especially with Syria coming back into the fold. 21 years ago, George Bush uttered these words in his State of the Union address.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
Ironic that now those words hold true for the U.S. and Israel, especially when it comes to their presence in the West Asia region.
On April the 5th, French President Emmanuel Macron made a three-day visit to China. It was Macron's first presidential visit to China since the COVID pandemic. The French president called on European countries to lower their dependence on the US dollar and resist pressure to become vassal states of Washington or get dragged into the China-US conflict over Taiwan. If the tensions between the two superpowers heat up, we won't have the time nor the resources to finance our strategic autonomy and we will become vassals. He further noted that the great risk for Europe is to get involved in a crisis that does not belong to it. The worst thing would be to think that we Europeans must be followers and adapt ourselves to the American rhythm and a Chinese overreaction.
La France est pour le sport, Taiwan.
France is for the status quo in Taiwan. France supports the One China policy and the search for a peaceful settlement of the situation. This is moreover the position of the Europeans and is a position which has always been compatible with the role of ally. But it is precisely here that I insist on the importance of a strategic autonomy. Being allies does not mean being a vassal.
The comments come amid heightened tensions between the U.S. and China over Taiwan. China staged a large-scale military drill after Taiwan's leader met with the U.S. House Speaker in California.
China and France have further expanded their economic and trade cooperation through the visit, which in fact has once again confirmed that the economic and trade cooperation acts as the ballast and stabilizer of the bilateral relations. As it is known to all, the visit took place against the backdrop that the United States is clamoring about decoupling or disruption of industrial chains of China. And the Biden administration has also been suppressing his European allies in the aspect. Therefore, the consensus and the fact that both sides continue to advance economic and trade cooperation by consolidating traditional domains and exploring new fields during the visit of President Macron to China are a powerful response to the so-called decoupling and disruption policies of the U.S.
Macron highlighted the point that Europe should be a third power in the world order along with the U.S. and China. He also emphasized the risks to Europe of the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act, a $369 billion green subsidy plan. Macron also said Europe should reduce its dependence on the extraterritoriality of the U.S. dollar, a stance that is likely to raise eyebrows in Washington. Macron's comments about Europe's independence from the United States and its devastating reliance on the U.S. dollar has sparked anger and concern in Washington. The White House reapparently affirmed ties with Paris.
Again, I'll let President Macron speak to his comments. We're very comfortable and confident in the strong alliance and the strong friendship that exists between our two countries and the fact that we have been working together on the continent. And elsewhere around the world with France, whether it's, I mentioned the Indo-Pacific, certainly on Ukraine, in Africa, in the Sahel, going after terrorist threats there. I mean, there's a lot of terrific bilateral cooperation just alone between the United States and France. We're focused on that. We're focused on making sure that together we're meeting the national security requirements of both our peoples.
Earlier, Republican Senator Marco Rubio urged European countries to clarify pretty quickly if Macron spoke for Europe or France alone.
And so I think this is a good moment for us to ask Europe, does Macron speak for all of Europe? Is Macron now the head of Europe? Is he now the most powerful leader in Europe? Because if he is, then there's some things we're going to need to change. Number one, you know, Europe, including France specifically, has depended heavily on the United States for 70 years for their own defense. As far as not getting involved in other conflicts that are not ours, we need to ask Europe, does he speak for them? Because we're pretty heavily involved in Ukraine right now. We're spending a lot of our taxpayer money on a European war.
Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, it's been Europe which has paid the high price for the conflict. The war has mostly benefited the United States and its huge military-industrial complex. That's one of the reasons why the Washington regime is pumping more weapons to Ukraine to keep the war going. Furthermore, France is seeking economic independence from the United States. Just recently, France conducted its first LNG purchase in the Chinese yuan. The roots of France's diplomacy of balance date back to General Charles de Gaulle's attempts to counterweight U.S. dominance. Under de Gaulle, France became the first Western nation to recognize the People's Republic of China back in 1964.
But I think fundamentally, what Macron is aiming at is strengthened Europe with regards to Russia, with regards to China, and also with regards to the US, I think is something that is largely shared within Europe. The problem being that his style of communication, his vocabulary, strategic autonomy, European sovereignty, is at times misunderstood, misinterpreted.
Macron may not be able to persuade the whole European bloc to reduce its dependence on the United States.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The director of U.S. Air National Guard has claimed personnel from the U.S. and Ukraine have been just a phone call away during the conflict. Meanwhile, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has said that discussions about the delivery of fighter jets to Kiev once again underline the growing involvement of Western regimes in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. He reiterated Moscow's stance that such actions only serve to escalate and prolong the fighting and would lead to more bloodshed while failing to change the ultimate outcome of Russia's military operation. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, American pilots have remained in constant contact with their Ukrainian counterparts during the crisis with Russia, advising on operational tactics and how to use U.S.-made weapons, Director of the U.S. Air National Guard, Lieutenant General Michael Lowe, has said. Air-launched weapons supplied by Washington to Kiev come with permanent U.S. support. Lowe reminded journalists at the Air and Space Forces Association Symposium in Colorado recently. The Americans initially explained to Ukrainian airmen what you need to do to survive the initial attack, with cooperation later expanding to, here's how you can continue to deliver air power, Lowe explained in comments cited recently by Business Insider. Most of this consulting has been provided through the California National Guard, which has been cooperating with Ukraine since the early 1990s as part of the National Guard's State Partnership Program, according to the report. This has reportedly allowed a Ukrainian soldier to pick up the phone to say, hey, I'm having a problem with this weapon system, to somebody who actually trained them and solve a problem on the ground, the general pointed out. Among other things, the U.S. general said the U.S. pilots have been advising the Ukrainians on how to conduct combat in line with the U.S. Air Force's concept for dispersed operations and on how to use U.S.-made weapons, including AGM-88 anti-radiation missiles and JDAM's guidance kits, which allow bombs to go farther. We are continuing to provide them the tactics, techniques, and procedures for things like agile combat employment and new weapon systems, Low said, as cited by Business Insider, adding that these consultations have continued over this last 13 months of conflict. While it has sent missiles and other weaponry to Ukraine, the U.S. regime has so far been reluctant to heed Kiev's call to provide it with F-16 fighter jets. However, NBC reported earlier this month that at least two Ukrainian pilots have been training on simulators at a military base in Arizona to establish how long it will take to train them to fly Western fighter jets. Russia has long decried deliveries of weapons to Ukraine by the U.S. regime and its allies, arguing that these only serve to escalate and prolong the fighting while also failing to change the ultimate outcome of the Russian operation. According to Moscow, arms deliveries, intelligence sharing and training provided to Kiev's troops and other forms of assistance have already made Western nations de facto parties to the conflict. NBC had earlier reported that the U.S. has invited Ukrainian pilots to a military base in Tucson, Arizona, to establish how long it will take to train them to fly Western fighter jets, including F-16s. Unnamed officials told NBC. Two airmen from Ukraine have arrived on American soil so far, with more likely to follow, the broadcaster reported recently. According to its sources, the U.S. authorities plan to bring as many as 10 Ukrainian aviators to the country this month. The pilots have been working on simulators and there are no plans for them to fly actual aircraft, the officials noted. The program has two goals: improving the Ukrainians' skills and assessing how long it will take to train them to effectively operate F-16s and other Western-made warplanes, they added. A Biden administration official claimed the program is about assessing their abilities as pilots so we can better advise them on how to use capabilities they have and we have given them. It's the first time that Ukrainian pilots who have been trained to fly Soviet-designed aircraft that differ significantly from their Western counterparts have taken part in such a program in the U.S., NBC pointed out. The officials who talked to the broadcaster stressed that the development did not mean there had been any change in Washington's stance on the delivery of F-16s to Kiev amid its conflict with Moscow. "I'm ruling it out for now," U.S. President Joe Biden claimed last week when asked about the possibility of arming Ukraine with American fighter jets. Ukrainian leader Zelensky doesn't need F-16s now. There is no basis upon which there is a rationale, according to our military, now to provide F-16s, Biden told ABC News. Kiev has intensified calls for NATO to supply it with fighter jets, particularly F-16 aircraft, in recent months after securing a pledge from EU countries, the US and UK, to provide dozens of Leopard 2, M1 Abrams and Challenger 2 main battle tanks, respectively. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov has said discussions about the delivery of fighter jets to Kiev once again underline the growing involvement of Western regimes in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. He reiterated Moscow's stance that such actions only serve to escalate and prolong the fighting and would lead to more bloodshed while failing to change the ultimate outcome of Russia's operation.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Imam Ridha alayhi salam's shrine on the occasion of the beginning of the Iranian New Year 1402, that's March 21st, 2023. One of the things that has often been a source of debate between the executive and legislative branches in different administrations and in all periods, thank God, the two branches are cooperating and are close to each other in the current period, is this complaint that sometimes in the annual budget law in Majlis, definite expenses are approved, but revenues are indefinite. This leads to a budget deficit, and as I said before, a budget deficit is a great economic disaster. These things should not happen. We also have other weaknesses in different fields, which I will leave for another time, God willing. The opposite of this transformational movement in the country, the purpose of which is to consolidate strengths and to eliminate weaknesses, is the politics of the enemies of Islam and the enemies of the Islamic Republic. They strive and work and take action at the exact opposite point of this transformational movement, and their goal is to strike at our strengths, as I mentioned before. We have no choice but to share these things with the public. People must know about them. On the day when Saddam attacked us at the beginning of the imposed war, we informed the people that same day that the country is at war. So public opinion was involved in the great event of the war. Of course, in this hybrid war that is currently taking place, there is no military attack. The enemy is not attacking militarily. It is doing other things instead. Informing the people is necessary here as well, so that the people become aware of the enemy's tactics and policies, and so that they can see events with clarity. Once our dear people become familiar with what is happening, if an incident happens, they will see it with clarity.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Yes, in hybrid warfare there is no military attack, but there is an attack on religious and political beliefs. The enemy's attack is on religious and political beliefs. In Surah An-Nas, when one says, from the evil of the devious tempter, who puts temptations into the chests of humans, from among the jinns and humans, the devious tempters are these foreign propagandists and their followers inside the country. They tempt people and they distort the truth. Their goal is to weaken the determination of the nation. They want to get rid of people's hopes. Their goal is to extinguish the flames of hope in the hearts of our youth. They want to create despair in the youth.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
New public health research on U.S. women's prisons exposes medical neglect, sexual violence, and inhumane living conditions. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truthout, the COVID-19 pandemic brought to the fore the public health crises unfolding in carceral settings across the United States. In California, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, CDCR, has documented more than 90,000 cases in state prisons, with more than 3,500 of those cases in women's prisons. People incarcerated in women's prisons have reported alarming neglect in CDCR's handling of the pandemic, including months spent in quarantine units, and the denial of the toilet paper, phone calls, cleaning supplies, and showers. But the health harms of incarceration existed long before the COVID-19 and continue to exist now. The recent research included interviewing and surveying people who are currently incarcerated in California's two remaining women's prisons, Central California Women's Facility, CCWF, and California Institution for Women, CIW. The findings paint a dire picture of people facing medical neglect, sexual violence, discrimination, and inhumane living conditions while incarcerated. In some ways, California's incarcerated population mirrors national social patterns. Due to the racism of the criminal legal system, 929 people in California's women's prisons were black in 2022. This is 25% of the prison population, while black people make up only 6.5% of California's total population. Furthermore, 83% of the survey respondents reported having an illness, injury, or disability, and 55% reported having three or more health conditions needing care. Ableism shapes how disabled people are policed, socioeconomically marginalized, and discriminated against in both the medical and legal sectors, leading disabled people to be disproportionately incarcerated. Indeed, studies show an estimated 66% of the incarcerated population in the U.S. is disabled, an estimated 40.4% with a psychiatric disability, and an estimated 56% with a non-psychiatric disability. Specifically, Estimations show that a higher percentage of people incarcerated in women's prisons reported disability, 79.5%, compared with people incarcerated in men's prisons, 64.6%. This is particularly troubling considering medical neglect is characteristic of incarceration. They found that 66% of the surveyed respondents reported that medical staff did not properly treat them. 60% reported that medical staff did not investigate the cause of their medical condition, and 51% reported that medical staff did not order diagnostic tests. Additionally, an alarming 40% of the survey respondents reported experiencing reproductive abuse, such as coerced sterilization or an untreated reproductive health issue while imprisoned. Several respondents shared that they woke up from unrelated surgeries to find that their ovaries or uterus had been removed. One woman said that she was waiting for paperwork from a surgery 2 years prior to find out if she was sterilized. This is part of a long and sordid history of marginalized Californians facing reproductive abuse. Last year, Governor Gavin Newsom allocated funds for a new program to compensate survivors of a state-sponsored sterilization, acknowledging the state's shameful past. The research found that such injustices still occur today in the U.S., and the governor has the opportunity and obligation to address them further. Also, according to China Daily, U.S. state and federal prisons saw deaths surging nearly 50% during the first year of the pandemic, and in six states, they more than doubled. The New York Times reported recently, citing the first comprehensive data on prison facilities in the era of COVID-19. The U.S. Daily said the tremendous jump in deaths in 2020 was more than twice the increase in the United States overall and even exceeded estimates of the percentage increase at nursing homes among the hardest hit sectors nationwide. While there was ample evidence that prisons were COVID hotspots, the data underscored how quickly the virus rampaged through crowded facilities and how an aging inmate population, a correctional staffing shortage, and ill-equipped medical personnel combined to make prisoners especially vulnerable during the worst public health crisis in a century, according to the report. COVID infections drove the death totals, but inmates also succumbed to other illnesses, suicide and violence, according to the data, which was collected by law school researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles. Altogether, at least 6,182 people died in American prisons in 2020, compared with 4,240 the previous year, even as the country's prison population declined to about 1.3 million from more than 1.4 million, the report said.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On Palestinian Prisoners' Day, marked every April 17th, protesters in Paris demanded an end to Western silence regarding Israel's horrific and illegal treatment of political prisoners. Since 1948, an estimated 1 million Palestinians have been arrested by Israelis due to waging an average of 10 police raids every single day. Israel arrests about 6,000 adults and 1,000 children annually. A new report revealed that 5,000 Palestinians are currently held in long-term Israeli prisons, including almost 200 children. More than 1,000 people have not even been charged with an alleged crime. Prisoners report that physical and psychological torture is not just routine, but shockingly brutal, and hundreds of Palestinians have died in Israeli custody. Many accuse the international community and Western-led human rights groups of abandoning those ensnared in Israeli occupation prisons.
The image of Israel is getting worse and worse with each passing day. What some don't seem to grasp is that Israel is a colonial project, and all of modern human history shows that the colonialists are the guilty ones, and not those who are colonized. The only choice Israel has is to stop its attempt to colonize Palestine.
Europe's longest-serving political prisoner is a pro-Palestinian resistance fighter held in France, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, who has become lionized as the Arab Nelson Mandela. Abdullah still refuses to recant his support for Palestine, and his continued imprisonment is widely viewed as a flagrant politicization of France's legal system.
The mistreatment and unjust incarceration of Georges Abdullah shows how France is directly involved in today's Middle Eastern politics. Releasing Abdullah back to Lebanon would threaten French imperialist and political interests in the region, and also those of its allies in the United States and Israel. Abdullah is a hero worldwide, and we insist on his immediate parole, which was initially granted over 20 years ago.
In neighboring Germany, protests in favor of Palestinian Prisoners' Day were banned. The Israeli occupation means that Palestinians endure terrorist tactics every single day. The brutality is even worse for those political prisoners stuck in Israeli jails. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Thousands of pro-Palestine activists from across the UK marched on Downing Street Sunday to mark the International Quds Day. They joined millions of other demonstrators engaging in similar action all across the globe, with the aim of empowering the Palestinian cause and condemning Zionism, the political ideology endeavouring to forcefully evict Palestinians from their historic homeland.
Initiated by the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979, International Quds Day is marked on the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan. However, in recent years in Europe, the day has come under attack, with critics trying to get the day banned outright.
Pro-Israel activists say the march is anti-Semitic, an accusation dismissed by organizers and attendees, including anti-Zionist religious Jews.